welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Here we are, well into autumn, the days Keats so aptly described as the season of mist and mellow fruitfulness. The publishers are ramping up their game and gearing up for the holidays ahead, and you and I are reaping the abundant literary harvest of a bumper crop of riches. This week, we'll delve into the fray and focus on an exciting new group of mysteries. So many titles. So which to read? The Book Report will bring you the cream of the crop, starting with new offerings by my guests today, Karen Slaughter, J.A. Chance, and Deb Pines. Plot twists and turns will keep you turning those pages. So let's turn now to page one of the Book Report. A secret chamber, a mysterious shipwreck, a murder in the marshes. Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child return with Crimson Shore. A seemingly straightforward private case turns out to be much more complicated and sinister than Special Agent Pendergast could have anticipated. Pendergast, together with his ward, Constance Green, travels to the seaside village of Exmouth, Massachusetts. They're there to investigate the theft of a priceless wine collection. But inside the wine cellar, they find something considerably more disturbing. A bricked-up niche that once held a crumbling skeleton. Pendergast soon learns that Exmouth is a town with a dark, troubled history. Local legends hold that during the 1692 Salem witch trials, the real witches escaped, fleeing north to Exmouth and settling in the surrounding marshes, where they continued to practice their wicked arts. Then, a murdered corpse turns up in the marshes. The only clue is a series of mysterious carvings. Could these demonic symbols bear some relation to the ancient witch's colony? René Aubergenois narrates.
As they strolled back up the main street, Constance saw a ticket fluttering on the Porsche's windscreen. Pendergast pulled it out and examined it. "It seems I parked straddling two spaces. How remiss of me." Constance saw that Pendergast had indeed parked the car squarely across two painted parking space lines. "But the entire street is practically free of parked cars. One must obey the law." Pendergast tucked the ticket into his suit pocket, and they got into the car. He started it up and eased back out into the main street. In a moment, they had passed through town and were out the other side, the shop buildings already giving way to modest shingled houses. The road rose up through grassy meadows bordered by massive oaks before coming out on higher land overlooking the Atlantic. Ahead, toward the bluffs, Constance could see the Exmouth Lighthouse, their destination. It was painted bone white with a black top and stood out against the blue sky. Next to it rose the keeper's residence, austere as an Andrew Wyeth painting. As they approached, Constance also made out a scattering of sculptures in a meadow along the edges of the bluff, rough-cut granite forms with polished and somewhat sinister shapes emerging from the stone, faces, body forms, mythical sea creatures. It was a striking location for a sculpture garden. Pendergast brought the roadster to a halt in the gravel drive alongside the house. As they got out, Percival Lake appeared in the door, then strode onto the porch. "Welcome. Good Lord, you certainly travel in style. That's a 55 Spider 550, if I'm not mistaken," he said as he came down the steps.
"A 54, actually," Pendergast replied. "It's my late wife's car. I prefer something more comfortable, but my associate, Miss Green, insisted on it."
"I did not," she interjected.
"Your associate?"
Constance did not like the way the man's eyebrows rose in ironical amusement as he looked at her.
"Pleased to see you again."
She shook his hand rather coldly.
"Let us visit the scene of the crime," said Pendergast.
"You don't waste any time. In a criminal investigation, There is an inverse relationship between the quality of evidence and the length of time it has been awaiting examination.
Right.
Lake led them into the house. They passed through a front hall and parlor with sweeping views of the ocean. The old house had been immaculately kept up, airy and fresh, with the sea breeze swelling the lace curtains. In the kitchen, an attractive bleached blonde in her 30s, slender and fit, was dicing carrots.
This is my associate, Carol Hinterwasser, Lake told them. Please meet Agent Pendergast and Constance Green. They are here to find my wine collection.
The woman turned with a smile, displaying white teeth, dried her hands on a cloth, and shook their hands in turn. Excuse me, I'm just making a mirepoix. I'm so glad you could come. Percy is really devastated. Those wines meant a lot to him, way more than the value.
Indeed, said Pendergast.
Constance could see his silvery eyes darting about.
This way, said Lake.
At the back of the kitchen stood a narrow door. Lake opened it, flicked on a light switch. It illuminated a set of steep, rickety stairs going down into darkness. A rich, cool smell of damp earth and stone rose up.
Take care, he cautioned. These steps are steep.
We've just heard Crimson Shore by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Karen Slaughter describes herself as a longtime resident of Atlanta, splitting her time between the kitchen and the living room. But if you keep tabs on the New York Times bestseller list, you'll see there's lots more to Karen. Her first novel, Blindsided, made the Crime Writers Association's Dagger Award shortlist for Best Thriller Debut of 2001. To date, Karen's books have sold more than 30 million copies. Karen has two incredibly popular series, Grant County and Will Trent. Today, though, we'll speak with her about her new standalone bestseller, Pretty Girls. Welcome, Karen. It's great to have you with us on the Book Report.
My pleasure.
First of all, congratulations. What's it like to open the New York Times and read Pretty Girls is a genuinely exciting narrative driven by strong-willed female characters who can't wait around until the boys shake the lead out of their shoes?
Well, you know, it's just amazing. It's something that you always want as an author, but to have your work confirmed as something that's valid is a wonderful thing.
Listeners who haven't read your book yet know that you are from the South. So what's it like to set this novel right in Georgia?
You know, all my novels are set in Georgia, and I feel really close to the state. I was born and raised here. I love writing about the experience of being Southern in the modern era, and I feel in some ways like I'm an ambassador for Atlanta because there's a lot of misconceptions about the South, and so, you know, the fact that we're all wearing shoes and not talking about how we lost the war is something I like to show in my novels.
And do you give homage to some of the previous, you know, fabulous Southern writers who come before you?
You know, I grew up reading Flannery O'Connor, and I just loved her work. The first time I read it, I was a kid, and I had no idea that she was actually accomplishing more than telling a good story. She was using shock and violence to pry off the scab from the human condition. And as an older person and in college, I began to understand that words and stories can be used for much more than just entertainment. There can be different layers to them.
That's so true. All right, let's get to Pretty Girls. Can you introduce us to Claire Scott?
Well, Claire opens the book, and when we meet her, you know, she seems to have a perfect life. She's wealthy. She's got a handsome husband who takes care of her, and, you know, everything seems very normal in her life. But, of course, this being a thriller, something awful happens in that first chapter, and it turns Claire's life upside down. And we find out that this isn't the first time that she's been negatively affected by crime 24 years prior to when we first meet her in the book. Her oldest sister, Julia, disappeared. She was a college student, young and pretty, and she was out walking on campus, and she just disappeared, and the family never found out what happened to her. And when I say family, I mean her mother and her father and her middle sister, Lydia, who also is in the book. And when we meet Lydia, she's estranged from Claire for reasons that become quickly clear.
Can you tell us a little more about Lydia? I think everybody loves Lydia.
Well, I love Lydia. You know, she is very close to me and my sense of humor. She's over 40, and she's realized that a lot of things she kept telling herself when she was younger, I'll get to that before I'm 40. Well, it's too late. You know, she embodies that sort of attitude of I'm just going to do the best I can and give myself a break, which I think is probably the only thing that's a positive about turning 40 is you kind of give yourself a break. But she has a daughter. She's had some struggles in her life. She went off the rails after her sister disappeared. She used drugs and alcohol to deaden that loss, and it took her a long time to get righted. But now her life is pretty good. She's got a great guy, and her daughter's about to go to college. But of course, you know, this being a thriller, as I said, something bad happens that shakes up her world.
You know, you get sibling relationships dead on, so to speak. Do you yourself have a sister?
I have two older sisters, and, you know, we fought like cats and dogs when we were little. I probably would have been happy if one of them disappeared, but as an adult, I understand, and, you know, I have a good relationship with them now, and I love writing about sister relationships because they're so fraught. You know, there's always some kind of history, and your sister knows you better than anybody else in the world, which could be a good and a bad thing.
You know, as you said, the book centers on what happens to families when a child goes missing. In your research for Pretty Girls, did you actually interview families who have had to live with this tragedy?
You know, I'm not a reporter. I'm a writer. I write mostly for entertainment, and I don't want to feel like I'm exploiting someone's horrible experience. But what I did was two things. One, I just imagined, okay, well, if I was in this situation, what would it feel like, which is an author's job. But I also looked at the internet because there are people who have posted things online who have had this tragedy happen to their family. You know, a family member disappears. They never hear from them again. They never know what happens. And I figure that if they're posting it on the internet, that's for general consumption. So I don't feel bad about looking at that.
You know, in preparing for this interview, I saw you are widely credited with coining the term investigoogling. What is that exactly?
Well, it's a deep Google search, you know, where you don't just look up, you know, what does this mole look like? You go deeper into it and read medical reports and read all of the information that's out there. So it's not just a quick check of Wikipedia.
We're speaking to Karen Slaughter on the book report. The cops in the book seem kind of a squirmy lot through most of the story. Do you ever get pushback from readers who are policemen and women?
For the most part, I write about cops as the good guys. And, you know, the thing is, I played with that a little bit in Pretty Girls because I didn't want you to feel completely certain you could trust the police. And as a narrative technique, I think that works very well. But when I'm writing about Will Trent, my series character, and I'm currently working on a book for next year that has Will Trent, I am very conscious that I have some makeup to do for Pretty Girls. And so I'm showing him as a hero, as a good guy. And honestly, he's like most cops. You know, we only hear about the handful of bad ones. He's doing his job. He really cares about people. He's risking his life. And, you know, I think sometimes it's easier to write about bad cops because we have that stereotype. But writing about a good cop is what I like to do.
There are so many plot twists in the book. Do you map them out before you start writing, or do you surprise yourself as you write?
I keep them in my head. You know, I'm not one of these surprise myself sorts of writers because I think very carefully about what I'm going to write before I write it. So by the time I sit down, it's pretty much done. It's all been in my head. It's all been worked out, the different beats of it. So I'm not surprised per se, but I do love it when I have that spark of inspiration about the twists and turns. And this novel has a lot of them, and I love that.
You know, you mentioned Will Trent. What made you veer away from Will Trent and write this standalone book, Pretty Girls?
As much as I love writing about Will Trent and writing a series, I thought, you know, I don't want to get bored with this. I want to take a little break. And so I wrote Pretty Girls, and prior to this, I wrote another novel called Cop Town about female officers in the 1970s. And I really appreciated that departure because now going back into Will Trent, I feel a renewed vigor for writing his story and passionate about talking about what he's doing in his life.
You have Lydia say early on, the world stops for you when you're pretty. That's why women spend billions on stuff for their faces. Their whole life, they're the center of attention. People want to be around them because they're attractive, their jokes are funnier, their lives are better, and then suddenly they get bags under their eyes or they put on a little weight and no one cares about them anymore. They cease to exist. You've certainly captured the angst of aging baby boomers. Where did you get this kind of insight?
Well, a bit of it is my own insight, just from my own life. You know, when you're young, you can be stupid and silly, and people pay attention to you more, and they forgive you more if you can manage to be attractive in the process. But it is true that, I mean, gosh, you're in radio, I'm in books, and my picture's on my books, and, you know, there's a tendency in the media to celebrate youth. And I think one positive influence of the baby boomers, because we could go on about some of the negative influences, but that it's okay now for women to age. You know, not too much, of course, but Meryl Streep certainly has paved the way, and baby boomers have said, hey, you know, I don't want to be irrelevant in my 50s or 60s or 70s. And it's really changed things, and I think that's had a knock-on effect to young women. You know, if you look at Lena Dunham and Jennifer Lawrence, and these women are suddenly talking about things such as equality, pay equality, and feminism, and there aren't those negative connotations that there were for my generation.
By the way, you look very fabulous on your book cover.
<Thank you. laughs>
Kathleen Early narrates this book, and she's done quite a few of your titles. Are you involved at all with the audio editions of your books?
Well, I am, and I was very careful about picking Kathleen. I really love what she does. And some of my earlier audio books, it sounded like they just found a trailer park and shaken out the crappiest accent they could find or the trashiest accent they could find. And I really felt upset about that because, you know, they had all the Southerners sounding like they were playing banjos and picking their teeth with straw. And I would call them on the phone and say, listen to me, this is how people in Atlanta sound. This is an Atlanta accent. And they would say, okay, but then they would go back to some twangy kind of thing that I, you know, hasn't been around since Andy Griffith. So I'm really pleased with Kathleen. She's from Savannah. We had a long conversation about what the characters would sound like, and I think she does a fantastic job.
Karen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bye now. To hear an audio sample of Pretty Girls, check bookreportradio.com, week of September 12th, 2015. Harry Bosch is back in Michael Connelly's The Crossing, book 20 in the series. And in the perfect storm for Connelly fans, Bosch is teaming up with Lincoln lawyer Mickey Haller, his half-brother. Okay, Bosch fans know Bosch has retired from the LAPD, but Haller needs his help. The murder rap against Mickey's client seems ironclad, but Mickey is sure it's a setup. Though it goes against all of his instincts, Bosch takes the case. With the secret help of his former LAPD partner, Lucia Sotto, he turns the investigation inside the police department. As Bosch gets closer to discovering the truth, it seems he's made himself a target. Titus Welliver narrates.
Harry slipped onto a bench in the back of the public gallery and watched as Haller questioned a uniformed Los Angeles police officer on the witness stand. Bosch had missed the preliminaries, but not the meat of Haller's examination of the officer. Officer Sanchez, what I would like you to do now is go through the steps that led to your arresting Mr. Hennigan on December 11th of last year, Haller said. Why don't we start with what your assignment was that day? Sanchez took a moment to compose an answer to what seemed to be a routine question. Bosch noticed that he had three hash marks on his sleeve, one for every 5 years with the department. 15 years was a lot of experience, and that told Bosch that Sanchez would be very wary of Haller, as well as skilled at giving answers more helpful to the prosecution than the defense. My partner and I were on routine patrol in 77th Street Division, Sanchez said. We happened to be traveling westbound on Florence Avenue at the time of this incident. And Mr. Hennigan was also traveling on Florence Avenue? Yes, that's correct. Which direction was he going? He was also going west. His car was directly in front of us. Okay, and then what happened? We came to a red light at Normandy, and Mr. Hannigan came to a stop, and then we stopped behind him. Mr. Hannigan engaged his right turn signal, and then he turned right to go northbound on Normandy. Did he commit a traffic code infraction by turning right when the light was red? No, he did not. He came to a complete stop, and then he made the turn when it was clear. Haller nodded and checked something off on a legal pad. He was sitting next to his client, who was in County Blues, a sure sign that this was a felony case. Bosch guessed it was a drug case and that Haller was trying to suppress whatever was found in his client's car by claiming it was a bad stop. Haller was questioning the witness from his seat at the defense table. Without a jury, the judge was not requiring the formality of standing when addressing a witness. "You made the turn as well, following Mr. Hennigan's car, correct?" he asked. "That is correct," Sanchez said. "At what point did you decide to conduct a traffic stop on Mr. Hennigan's vehicle?" "It was right away. We lit him up, and he pulled over." "Then what happened?" "The minute he stopped the car, the passenger door opened, and the passenger bolted." "He ran?" "Yes, sir." "Where did he go?" "There is a shopping plaza there with an alley behind it. He went into the alley in an easterly direction." "Did either you or your partner give chase?" "No, sir. It would be against policy and dangerous to separate. My partner got on the radio and requested backup and an airship. He broadcast a description of the man who ran." "An airship?" "A police helicopter." "Got it. What did you do, Officer Sanchez, while your partner was on the radio?" "I exited the patrol car and moved to the driver's side of the vehicle and told the driver to put his hands out the window where I could see them." "Did you draw your weapon?" "Yes, I did." "Then what happened?" "I ordered the driver, Mr. Hannigan, to step out of the vehicle and lie down on the ground. He complied, and then I handcuffed him." "Did you tell him why he was under arrest?" "At that time, he was not under arrest." "He was handcuffed face down on the street, but you are saying he was not under arrest?" "We didn't know what we had, and my concern was for the safety of myself and my partner. We'd had a passenger bolt from the car, so we were suspicious about what was going on here." "So the man bolting from the car was what set all of this in motion?" "Yes, sir." Haller flipped some pages on his yellow pad to look at notes and then checked something on the screen of his laptop, which was open on the defense table. His client had his head tilted down, and from behind it looked as though he might be asleep. The judge, who had been slumped so low in his seat that Bosch had only been able to see the top of his gray head, cleared his throat and leaned forward, revealing himself to the courtroom. The placard at the front of the bench identified him as the Honorable Steve Yared. Bosch didn't recognize him, or his name, which didn't mean a whole lot, since the building housed more than 50 courtrooms and judges. "Nothing further, Mr. Haller?" he asked. "I'm sorry, Your Honor," Haller said. "Just checking some notes." "Let's keep this moving." "Yes, Your Honor." Haller apparently found what he was looking for and was ready to proceed. "How long did you leave Mr. Hannigan handcuffed on the street, Officer Sanchez?" "I checked the car, and once I was sure there was no one else in it, I went back to Mr. Hannigan, patted him down to check for weapons, then helped him up and placed him in the backseat of the cruiser for his own safety and ours."
That was a sampling of The Crossing by Michael Connelly. J.A. Jantz is an incredibly prolific author with several popular mystery series, each centering on a different character. There's retired Seattle police detective J.P. Beaumont with 24 books in the series, Arizona County Sheriff Joanna Bradley with 17 books in the series, and former L.A. news anchor turned mystery solver Allie Reynolds, 11 books in that series, plus 5 interrelated thrillers about the Walker family. J.A. was born in South Dakota and raised in Bisbee, Arizona. She's a graduate of the University of Arizona. Before becoming an author, J.A. worked selling insurance, as a teacher, and as a school librarian on a Native American reservation. Welcome, J.A., and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
I am happy to be here, Elaine.
I love the opening sentence in Dance of the Bones. Quote, Amos Warren walked in with shoulders stooped and with his eyes and mind focused on the uneven ground beneath his feet. How long does it take you to write the all-important opening sentence? Do you struggle with it, or does it just pop into your head?
The opening scenes usually come easily. It's the rest of the stuff that's hard to do.
Okay. Dance of the Bones intertwines several of your popular characters. Can you give us some backstory on investigator J.P. Beaumont and Detective Brandon Walker?
Well, I've been writing about Bo since 1982. He started out as a Seattle homicide cop, and for the past several years, he's worked for a unit called the Special Homicide Investigation Team, which, if you read it out, has a very unfortunate acronym.
Right.
Probably not say over the radio.
But correct.
There's an ongoing joke in all of the books about what people think about that acronym. But that organization, by the time Dance of the Bone starts, has been shuttered, and Bo is sort of at loose ends. Brandon Walker started out as a newly minted homicide detective in the first Walker book, Hour of the Hunter. And then he went on to become sheriff of Pima County for a number of years. And now he, too, is retired and working as a volunteer for an organization called The Last Chance, which is a collection of former police officers and forensic folks who investigate cold cases. So in this book, Amos Walker dies early on, and Brandon Walker, 40 years ago, was the detective who arrested him and sent him to prison for murdering his friend Amos. Now, another organization has, sort of based on the Innocence Project, has won him either a new trial or he can plead guilty to second-degree murder and be let out on time served. He doesn't want to be let out on time served. He wants to find whoever really did it. And he goes back to the guy who arrested him, Brandon Walker, and asks him to help.
Yes. You know, I really enjoyed how you introduced chapters with stories of the Tohono O'odham Nation. And pardon me if I mispronounce that, but can you tell us a little about them?
The Tohono O'odham have lived in the desert west of what is now Tucson for thousands of years. Actually, the word Tucson comes from the Tohono O'odham Chukchan, which means at the base of the Black Mountain. I went to the reservation in 1968, in the fall of 1968, as a librarian at Indian Oasis Schools. And as I came into the little basin where Sells is located, we drove into this haze of wood smoke, because in 1968, people were still mostly cooking over cook fires outside. So I knew less than nothing. I went to the reservation, and the friends I made there took me into their circle, and they taught me the legends and lores of the Tohono O'odham people. And what's magic about folklore and legend is that those stories cross all barriers of national boundary, ethnicity, time, language. And as when I gave myself permission to put them into the first book, it seemed magic the way those stories and my story wove together in a way that was more like French braiding a book than writing it.
We're speaking with J.A. Dance on the Book Report.
So there were a lot of bad things. I went back to the reservation because they invited me to come do a book signing at the Tribal Museum. And I was a little concerned about going back. And my purpose in writing those books was to bring my readers into this welcoming circle. So we went to the reservation. My husband, my second husband, the good one, and I went to Topala, a 70-mile drive from Tucson on a blustery February morning. And when we got to the parking lot, I was astonished because there were cars from Michigan and Wisconsin and Illinois and Iowa and Wyoming, because all of my snowbird fans who had seen a posting of the event had come to see it. At this book signing, they brought out a group of young people, and the MC said, when we open it for social dancing, you're welcome to take photos then, and if you wish, you can come join the circle. So as they were dancing, I thought, okay, I've griped about this for 40 years. Now is my time to join the circle. And when they opened it for social dancing and I stood to go join the circle, they came down and danced in the circle with me.
J.A., you split your time between Arizona and Seattle, two very different places. Do you find yourself writing differently in each area?
Well, I find myself writing differently in each book, and, you know, in for each of the four separate series. I grew up in Arizona. I know how the desert smells. I know the distances. I know the towns. But I was married to a man who was allowed in the creative writing program that was closed to me, and who told me there was only going to be one writer in our family, and he was it. I needed to get away because I still loved him. I divorced him to save my life. I didn't divorce him because I stopped loving him. And because I was afraid I was susceptible and would take him back, I moved the kids and me with a U-Haul trailer from Phoenix to Seattle. And in Seattle, I finally had the courage to start living my lifelong dream of becoming a writer. So Arizona is my home, and Seattle is my creative home.
J.A., any final thoughts about the book?
On the reservation, I learned that the story must end where it begins.
Well, J.A., thank you so much for stopping by the book report today.
You're welcome. I'm so happy to be here.
All right. Goodbye now.
Bye.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of Dance of the Bones, performed by J.R. Horn.
She knew John and Amos were partners who split everything 50-50. She probably understood that, for the most part, Amos was the brains of the outfit, while John was the brawn. Amos was the one who knew where to go seeking to find the hidden treasures the unyielding desert would reveal to only the most persistent of searchers. He knew what was worth taking home and what wasn't. John was the pack horse who carried the stuff and loaded it into the back of the truck and who carried it into the storage unit. When it came to selling their finds, Amos had years' worth of contacts at his disposal, all of them listed in his little black book. He had amassed a whole catalog of gem, mineral, and artifact dealers, some above board and others not so much. He also knew which of those might be interested in which items. Amos did the behind-the-scenes wheeling and dealing, while John handled direct sales at booths in the various venues. John was a good-looking young hunk, which was always a good bet when it came to face-to-face interactions. Amos suspected that John had gotten into his cups and talked too much about what they did and how much money they brought in, something Amos regarded as nobody's business but their own. He was convinced that was what Ava Martin was really after, the shortest route to the money. Amos had sent the little witch packing, and he'd no intention of telling John about it. But Ava had gotten the drop on him. She had told John all about their little set-to. The problem was, in Ava's version of the story, Amos had been the one putting the make on her, with predictable results. The previous evening, Amos had gone to El Barrio, a run-down bar and speedway on the east side of I-10. Years earlier, El Barrio had been within walking distance of the house where he had once lived. When developers came through and bought up that whole block of houses, Amos had taken his wad of money and paid cash for a 5-acre place up in Golder Canyon, on the far back side of Catalina. The house was a 10-roofed adobe affair that had started out long ago as a stage stop. In town, John and Amos had been roommates. The cabin, as Amos liked to call it, was strictly a one-man show. So John had chosen to stay on in town, closer to the action, and had rented a place in the old neighborhood. When Amos had gone to El Barrio that night, he had done so deliberately, knowing it was most likely still John's favorite hangout. Amos's mind was made up. He went there for no other reason than to have it out with John. John was hot-tempered, and Amos knew he was spoiling for a fight, something Amos preferred to avoid. He had come here hoping to talk things out rather than duking them out. He took a careful sip of his drink. "Good afternoon to you, too," he responded calmly. "Care for a beer?" "I don't want a beer from you or anything else either. You keep telling me that Ava's bad news and claiming she's not good enough for me. But the first time my back is turned, you try getting her into the sack." "That what Ava told you?" Amos asked. "It's not just what she told me," John declared, his voice rising. "It's what happened." Looking in the mirror behind the bar, Amos saw the reflection of John as he was now, a beefy man 7 inches taller than Amos, 30 pounds heavier, and 3 decades younger, with a well-deserved reputation as a brawler, and an equally well-deserved moniker, Big Bad John. Amos's problem was that, at the same time he saw that image, he was remembering another one as well, one of a much younger kid, freckle-faced and missing his 2 front teeth. That was how John, Johnny back then, had looked when Amos had first laid eyes on him.
That was Dance of the Bones by J.A. Jantz. Depraved Heart is book 23 in Patricia Cornwell's K. Scarpetta series. This time out, Scarpetta is working on a suspicious death scene in Cambridge, Mass., when an emergency alert sounds on her phone. A video link lands in her text messages and seems to be from her computer genius niece, Lucy. But how can it be? It's clearly a surveillance film of Lucy taken almost 20 years ago. As Scarpetta watches, she learns frightening secrets about her niece, whom she's loved and raised as a daughter. That film clip and others sent soon after raise dangerous legal implications that isolate Scarpetta and leave her knowing not where to turn. Can she tell her FBI husband or her investigative partner, Pete Marino? This intensely psychological odyssey moves from the mysterious death of a Hollywood mogul's daughter to aircraft wreckage at the bottom of the sea in the Bermuda Triangle to a grisly gift left in the back of a crime scene truck. The diabolical presence behind what unfolds seems obvious, but strangely, not to the FBI. They raid Lucy's estate and begin building a case against her that could send her to prison for the rest of her life. Susan Erickson performs the book.
I imagine odors and sounds as colors in a spectrum or instruments in an orchestra. I'm good at singling them out. Cologne, for example. Some cops wear a lot of it, and Hyde's masculine, musky fragrance is as loud as his voice. I can hear him in the next room talking about me, asking what I'm doing, and if I'm aware that the dead woman was into drugs, was probably a psych case, a wacko, a frequent flying Looney Tune. The cops are wandering about, bantering as if I'm not here. And Hyde leads the charge with his boisterous, clunky snipes and asides. He doesn't hold back, especially when it comes to me. What's Doc Mort found? How is Chief Zombie's leg after, you know? Whisper, whisper. What time is Count K returning to her coffin? I guess that's not a good thing to say, considering what went down 2 months ago in Florida. I mean, do we know for a fact what really happened at the bottom of the sea? We sure it wasn't a shark that got her? Or maybe she speared herself accidentally? She's okay now, right? I mean, that really had to f*** her up. She can't hear me, right? His words and not-so-quiet whispers are around me like shards of glass that glint and cut. fragments of thoughts. Ignorant, banal ones. Hyde is the master of dumb nicknames and comes up with dreadful puns, and I remember what he said as recently as last month when a group of us met at the Cambridge watering hole, Paddy's, to toast Pete Marino's birthday. Hyde insisted on buying me around, on treating me to a stiff drink, maybe a Bloody Mary, or a sudden death, or a spontaneous combustion. To this day, I'm not sure what the latter is, but he claims it includes corn whiskey and is served flaming. It might not be lethal, but will make you wish it were, he must have said 5 times. He dabbles in comedy, occasionally does stand-up in local clubs. He thinks he's quite entertaining. He's not. Is Dr. Death still here? I'm in the foyer. I drop my purple nitrile exam gloves into a red biohazard bag, my Tyvek-covered boots making slippery sounds as I move around the bloody marble floor, staring at the display on my phone. Sorry, Dr. Scarpetta. Didn't know you could hear me. I can. Oh, I guess you heard everything I was just saying. I did. Sorry. How's your leg? Still attached. Can I get you anything? No, thanks. We're making a Dunkin' Donuts run. Hyde's voice sounds from the dining room, and I'm vaguely aware of him and other cops walking, opening cabinets and drawers. Marino's not with them now. I no longer hear him, and don't know where he is inside the house, and that's typical. He does his own thing, and he's competitive. If there's anything to find, he'll be the one who does, and I should be looking around too, but not now. My priority this moment is the image of 411, what we used to call Lucy's FBI dorm room in Quantico, Virginia. So far, the recording is devoid of people, narration, or even captions as it plays on second by second, offering nothing but the static image of Lucy's empty Stark former quarters. I pay attention to the subtle background sounds, turning up the volume, listening through my wireless earpiece. A helicopter, a car, gunshots on distant firing ranges.
We've just heard Depraved Heart by Patricia Cornwell. Deb Pines was a newspaper reporter for 2 decades at the Indianapolis Star, the New York Law Journal, and other publications before she was bitten by the mystery writing bug. In 2013, her debut, In the Shadow of Death, a Chautauqua murder mystery, was published. Deb splits her time between writing her mysteries and working at the New York Post as an editor and award-winning headline writer. Today, Deb stops by to speak about Deliver Us from Evil, her 3rd Chautauqua mystery. Welcome, Deb. It's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Thank you for having me back. I always love your show, and I love talking to you.
Tell us a little about Chautauqua, which, I learned from your book, is an Iroquois word for bag tied in the middle.
Okay. Well, Chautauqua is the Chautauqua Institution is where I set my murder mysteries. And it's a churchy, quirky, historic arts community that's set on the lake, the Iroquois we're describing, because the lake is cinched in the middle with that bag tied in the middle shape. So that gives the name to the Chautauqua Institution and also to that whole region of western New York. Some people call it summer camp for adults. Some people call it Brigadoon because it comes alive for every summer for a 9-week season of lectures, concerts, church services, recreational activities, classes, a lot of stuff.
So how many people actually come to Chautauqua during the summer season?
150,000 people come to Chautauqua over the course of the 9 weeks. Most of them come for 1 week, but if they're close by, like in Jamestown, New York, or Erie, Pennsylvania, they might come for 1 concert or 1 day.
All right, let's get down to the book. Introduce us to Mimi Goldman, and how much of Mimi is based on you?
Okay. Well, I love that question. And one time I was talking to some teenagers and some kid asked me, is me, me, you, you? I have to say that we do share a lot of things, although Mimi, I like to say, is younger, braver, and prettier than me. We're both Jewish ladies. We're both Brooklyn natives. I was born in the Midwood section of Brooklyn where Mimi grows up, although I left there when I was 6 years old when my parents split up. And we moved to live initially with my grandparents who are in Miami Beach. So Mimi and I both, grandparents played a central role in our childhood. Mimi's grandparents are Holocaust survivors. Mine were not, but my best friend growing up, her parents were Holocaust survivors. So I drew upon that experience some. Mimi and I are both posties, which means we have a connection to the New York Post. Mimi used to be a reporter at the Post and an editor. I am still a copy editor at the New York Post. So we're both fussy grammarians. We write funny tabloid headlines. And that's my day job, even though I do it at night. I have one other thing about Mimi and me is a lot of mystery heroes and heroines are fearless, shoot first, ask questions later types. Mimi and I are both big worriers, and we have a lot of fears that Mimi has to talk herself out of. Her son tells her to fake it till you make it. So Mimi, unlike me, she carries a gun. She solves crimes. She's kind of my fantasy. I'm living vicariously through her adventures.
Mimi works for the local Chautauqua newspaper, The Daily. Does the paper close after the 9-week season? And then what does Mimi do the rest of the year?
Yes, Mimi is the newspaper does close the rest of the year. It's just it's mostly staffed by college interns in the summer, although there are a few adults like Mimi. And in each of these books, she was thinking she was in Chautauqua just temporarily. The first time was a short stint in the summer. This time, again, she thinks she's just there temporarily, so she hasn't worked out her plans yet.
We're speaking with Deb Pines on the Book Report.
Mimi's son Jake was 15 in your first Chautauqua mystery, In the Shadow of Death. That title was published in 2013. Now, just 2 years later in Deliver Us from Evil, we see Jake is 31. Why did you decide to move the characters forward that quickly?
Okay, very good question, Elaine. The thing is, the first book was published in 2013, but I actually wrote it in 1997 and set it in 1997. And that was when my children were about Jake's age then, 15. That book never went anywhere. I tried to sell it. It's a familiar story of the writing game. I tried to sell it. I tried dozens and dozens of agents, dozens of publishers. Never could get anything anywhere with it. It sat as a stack of papers in my in-law's house. Fast forward to 2012, a niece of mine read the papers. She said she liked it. Why didn't I ever do anything with it? I decided to self-publish it. Self-published it, thinking maybe it's a one-time thing. It ended up finding an audience in Chautauqua mainly. It's a top seller at the Chautauqua Institution Bookstore. So I started to think, all right, maybe I'll do one more Chautauqua murder mystery with Mimi. So that I actually wrote in, 2012, and set it in contemporary time now that my children are grown up, and like Jake. And again, this book, and people have received it well, so I'm thinking of doing one more.
The Amish people play a big part in the book. How did you research them? Were you able to speak with community members for background?
The Amish part is I love research, and so I did a tremendous amount of reading about the Amish. I saw some documentaries. National Geographic has two fabulous ones, one on the Amish in general and one on Amish who've left. The Amish, you think of them as just being in Pennsylvania, or I think of them in just Pennsylvania. In fact, they're mainly in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Indiana, but they're the fastest growing population is in New York around Chautauqua. They moved there in the 1970s, and so I did a lot of reading about the Amish, but I did also interview one woman who lives near Chautauqua and works as a cleaning lady for many years in Chautauqua.
In researching your bio, I learned about an unusual competition you recently participated in. Can you fill us in?
Okay, well, as I said, I work for the New York Post for the copy desk, and we're most known for our headlines. I'm not sure if people outside New York know the headlines, but there are a lot of wordplay, a lot of attitude. Our most famous is, you know, headless body and topless bar. We have a lot of puns. And so the competition was a pun competition. A lot of young people once a month compete in a very elaborate rules pun competition. They challenged the New York Post to compete against them. Mercifully, they changed the rules a little bit. So instead of their usual punning, they made it so we had to come up with headlines for hypothetical, you know, fictional news stories. But I'd have to say they didn't change the rules enough. So we, my team, the Post team, against the punsters who are call themselves Punderdome, we still had only 90 seconds to come up with our headlines, and we had to recite them on a stage in front of 500 people. I would say it was a lot of fun, but it was also very humbling. They just kicked our butts, if that's what I have to say on the radio. And we are a witty bunch, I think, but we do better sitting at a desk and having more than 90 seconds to come up with our answer.
Where can listeners outside of Chautauqua find your book?
You can find it on Amazon. It's available. All the books are available as an e-book or a paperback book. Anyone who's anti-Amazon can order it from the Chautauqua Institution Bookstore or the Mysterious Bookshop in New York City.
All right. Well, Deb, your book was so much fun. Thank you for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you so much, Elaine.
Minute Zero is an extraordinary international thriller by Todd Moss, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State. In the life of every country, at a moment of extreme national disruption, there is a brief period of breakdown. Everything becomes uncertain. Events can turn on a dime. That is the moment to act, to shape events. That is Minute Zero. State Department crisis manager Judd Riker is thrown into a quickly developing emergency in Zimbabwe, where a longtime strongman is being challenged for the presidency. Rumors fly furiously. Armed gangs, military crackdowns, shady outside money pouring in, and most disturbing, reports of highly enriched uranium leaking into the market. If Riker can't control and shape his Minute Zero, people, including himself, are going to die. Peter Marek performs the book.
Without making eye contact, the African spoke.
My brother, all this smoke. I need to quit smoking.
What is your brand of cigarette? Asked the American.
Marlboro.
The American nodded.
Where's my dossier? First, the gift.
The American glanced over both shoulders, then eyed his contact. After a hesitation, he reached into his jacket and withdrew an envelope. It quickly disappeared into the old man's pocket.
We walk?
That's not the deal, said the American, grabbing the other man's forearm. Give me the dossier, or I am leaving with my money.
No, too many eyes here, he said. Not safe.
He pulled away from the American's grip and dialed a number on a cheap flip phone. In short bursts, he whispered,
The Marlboro man is here. We are on our way.
He snapped the phone closed and grabbed the American's hand.
This way, my brother.
Silently, the two men walk down another path toward the bridge, spanning the 650-foot gorge between Zimbabwe and neighboring Zambia. The bridge had been built to signal friendship between the two allies, but instead, it provided a constant reminder of the stark trajectories of the two countries. Two nations, two anchors of the British Empire in Africa. Zambia had been granted independence in 1964, and Zimbabwe, then called Rhodesia, was supposed to have been next. But white settlers preempted London and declared Rhodesia independent. As Zimbabwe descended into a long and nasty civil war, Zambia basked in the confidence of a new nation, even allowing guerrillas to use its territory to fight the Rhodesians and the South African apartheid juggernaut. In 1980, the Rhodesian War ended and Zimbabwe gained its own independence. But by this time, Zambia had slumped into a morass of corruption and debt. Zimbabwe was the new hope. 2 decades later, the tide had turned again. Zambia was back on the rise while Zimbabwe was rotting. As the young American stepped onto the Victoria Falls Bridge, Zimbabwe was poisoning itself with a toxic cocktail of greed, dictatorship, and fear. At that moment, however, the American wasn't thinking about that. After a few steps, he stopped. I don't like this. I'm going back. He peered over the railing, scanning for crocodiles 420 feet below.
My brother, it is up to you.
The African hid his impatience.
You have come all this way. The choice is yours.
Shit, the old man is right. The American had spent most of the past 8 months working towards this moment. All the hours spent digging into files, all the late nights tracking bank records, the long hot days taking testimony in a sweaty thatched hut. He was now so close. Success depended on the final piece, the dossier. Success and a big promotion. Let's do it, he said, pointing at his contact's chest. But if you f*** me, you and your boss are dead. The old man laughed, not the reaction the American had expected.
There is no need for that, my brother.
Dead meat, the American muttered under his breath. The two strode across the bridge, passing a Swedish couple holding hands and a young Zimbabwean family. Most of the other tourists had retreated to their hotels for a sundowner. Gin and tonics were still popular among certain crowds in this part of the world, and an early dinner of plate-sized steaks. 2 middle-aged African men, also in suits, approached from the opposite side of the bridge. One was holding a legal-sized manila envelope. The 4 men met at the very center, the border, the highest point. The American accepted the envelope in silence, turned his back to the others to open it and claim his prize. The cover was a fuzzy black-and-white photocopy of an Ethiopian passport. So far, so good. The next page was blank, and the next, and the next. He scrunched his forehead as anger rose within him.
That was Minute Zero by Todd Moss. The Golem of Paris, co-written by father and son team Jonathan and Jesse Kellerman, resurrects LAPD detective Jacob Lev, the central character of one of last year's most quirky and compelling thrillers, The Golem of Hollywood. In this new title, it's been a year since Jacob Lev learned the remarkable truth about his family, and he's not coping well. He's back to drinking, he's not talking to his father. The LAPD Special Projects Department continues to shadow him, and the memory of a woman named Mai haunts him day and night. Then Jacob comes across the file of a gruesome, unsolved murder that brings the two halves of his life into a startling collision. Finding the killer will take him halfway around the world to Paris, the city of light, but also of the gritty streets behind the lights. A dangerous search for truth plunges him into the past, and for Jacob Lev, there is no place more frightening. John Rubinstein does the narration.
On the bowl of her back, she rocks from side to side, managing to flop onto her belly. Flapping her wings slowly, she ascends cautiously in captive space until she touches a solid surface, the roof of her prison, river mud hardened to ceramic. Tucking her legs in, she braces herself, pushes. It is like arguing with a cliff. She struggles and struggles, and meanwhile the gray has begun to drain, taking her strength with it, time running down. No! Abandoning caution, she begins slamming herself upward again and again and again, at last settling on her side, exhausted, gutted by pain, shell split clean open, bleeding, jaws bent, wings shredded, watching the air as it steadily quiets, her eyes closing 100 at a time. Noting with satisfaction, before all goes black, a pale, slim fissure, a crack in the darkness of clay.
That was The Golem of Paris by Jonathan and Jesse Kellerman. Readers, Henry David Thoreau once said, "How can they expect a harvest of thought who have not had the seed time of character?" I hope you'll agree these titles we previewed today have brought us compelling characters, ones worthy of your time. In the busy season that's just ahead, I hope you'll find the time to relax and recharge with a great book. My website, bookreportradio.com, is here to help with suggestions of top titles across the literary landscape. Thanks for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.